Welcome to Fusion, a show for Relay FM members where I talk to hosts from various shows about a single topic. Hello, my name is Stephen Hackett, and this month I'm joined by Shelly, she hosts Parallel, and Austin Evans from The Test Drivers to talk about the newly announced M1 powered Macs. Shelly, how are you?
I'm well, Stephen. I'm doing great. Glad it's Friday. Glad there are new Macs on our plates.
It's a fun week for computer nerds. You know, we don't get many good weeks, right? Gamers get lots of weeks. Phone people get lots of weeks. Computer nerds, it's our time to shine.
It's true.
Austin, how are you?
I am so happy that we have made it through the week that included a new PS5, a new Xbox, new iPhones coming out, and a new Apple event around Macs. Like, are you kidding me?
And in November, right, usually the tech industry has these sort of wave-like calendar, right, where we have a month that's busy and then it's a little bit quieter. This year, though, I'm sure because of the pandemic, a lot of things have slid a little later in the year. If you had told me a year ago that my October and November would have been as busy as September normally is, I wouldn't have believed you. It's been relentless.
It's weird because I think that there was a very real possibility that the tech space was quiet this year, right? Like, especially, you know, you think earlier this year, I was like, oh, okay, well, it's going to be a quiet year. A lot of things can just get pushed. But I'm so surprised at the effort and the ability for so many of the companies to be able to actually keep things at least somewhat on track and schedule, right? I mean, there's a scenario in which we could have been sitting here being like, well, I'm glad that we got one thing that came out this year. So how's it going?
Yeah. I do kind of wonder about next year. Like, if you think about how long it takes to develop something like a new iPhone, right? Apple is working years in advance. Samsung, all these companies, they have a multi-year cycle. And I do wonder if it's going to be a little bit of an echo effect where, yeah, this year the challenge was getting it manufactured and shipped. But what about that phone or that computer that's going to come out in 2021, is that going to be pushed to 22? You know, we would never know, I think, but I do wonder if some of that's like a little bit of a delayed effect.
But even from the software side, I mean, we had development that took place this year under circumstances that we know very little about, but that were very different than they had been previously. And that certainly would have had less impact on a 2020 release than it will on a 2021 release. And I remember last year in 2019, we were really on Apple for a lot of the software problems that they were having. And this year seems to be less of an issue. Mm-hmm. And it'll be really interesting to see how 2021 looks going forward, especially since they have separately hardware challenges with sourcing things and, you know, just getting all the pieces to fit together when they're working in, you know, not ideal circumstances.
So let's talk about some of this new stuff. We have Apple's big moment in the sun, right? We have now seen their move to their own silicon. Apple's been making its own chips now for quite a long time, starting in the iPad and then moving into these other devices, the watch, the HomePod, you know, everything else. But now we sit here and we have Macs, you know, on the way into the world with Apple Silicon parts. And so, Austin, I want to ask you first, coming into this event, I think a lot of us expected that we would be seeing sort of the entry level low power Macs go first. And that's pretty much what Apple delivered. But what about this surprised you? What about this maybe you weren't expecting?
I wasn't expecting such an enormous middle finger to Intel in every possible way, I think would be the big takeaway. I mean, look, we don't see leaps like this very often, but the writing's been on the wall for a long time, right? So there's this excellent Anontech article that breaks down specifically the A14, but you can infer a lot about the M1 chip from that. And the thing that was most striking to me is when you look at the graph of performance, right? So you start with the A7, which blew everyone away back in the iPhone 5S, of just how far they had pushed the envelope, how far they were ahead of bringing like 64-bit into the platform. Like, that chip was incredible. And I remember that when that was was first announced, they made a big deal about calling it sort of desktop class. And everyone was like, sure, it's okay for a phone chip. But there's a very clear line from that chip all the way to today with the M1, where you can see that Apple has relentlessly innovated and just raised the bar in such a ridiculous way. And that the chip in a new iPhone 12 mini, right? Not even just counting, like, you know, the Pro Max or the iPad or the Max, even just like the what's in the 12 mini can outperform in many regards the most powerful CPUs on the market, period. That is a mind-blowing stat, especially when you consider that that little phone is running with an order of magnitude less power than some of these bigger chips. It is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's one of those kind of once-in-a-generation changes. Right, that they're moving to something all new, and that instantly puts them so far ahead.
Yeah.
Shelley, what about you? Is there something that caught you off guard in Tuesday's announcement?
I don't know. I was a little surprised that there was a MacBook Pro, but just in terms of the way that the announcements were handled, I was astonished by how sort of WWDC-like this was, because there was so much technical detail about the chip. I mean, even to the diagram of the contents of the chip, a lot of charts, a lot of statistics that, of course, can be selectively read because they chose statistics that benefited them. And I think a lot of people came out of it going, well, this sounds really great, but now it's time to put it to the test. But they really focused on the sort of nerdy bits rather than saying, this is your next consumer Mac, even though they were selling MacBook Airs and MacBook and Minis, which are going to go to either a low-end market or a sort of a hobbyist market that wants to learn what this thing is going to do for them. And so I was delighted to see how sort of realistic and how focused they were on that side of things instead of, I mean, there were certainly plenty of instances when they talked about things being remarkable and amazing and awesome, as they usually do. But I don't think they were
being... What's the clock speed? Nobody knows.
Well, there is that. But I still think that they sort of kept on the side of realism in terms of, look, we're putting these out. These are the first generation. We have them all allegedly the same chip at the same clock speed, although probably not. And it's not going to be, again, it's not going to be like your holiday gift to your grandma, probably, but it is the beginning of something. And again, as they did at WWDC, they roadmapped it a little bit. They reminded us it's going to take them 2 years to get this done. And that felt like a very un-Apple, but very welcome thing for them to do.
I don't know. I mean, my grandma's in the market for an iMac Pro, so. You know,
What a cool grandma.
That's because she's your grandma, Stephen.
Yeah. I got to tell her the MacBook Air is just as fast in single core performance, probably. Before we get into the devices themselves, you know, Austin, you mentioned sort of the relationship with Apple and Intel, but it's not just Apple, right? A bunch of other companies build around these chips, and other companies have had the same frustration and the same level of stagnation that Apple has had in its Macs. What do you think the future of that is? Is it AMD coming in? Is it the PC industry turning to ARM in a new way? Like, what is next for Intel after this?
It's tough. I mean, when you talk about sort of long tails on things of Apple working on iPhones years in advance, I think that goes doubly so for the chip side of any of these businesses, whether it's AMD or Intel or Qualcomm or Apple. I mean, the timescales of when you start designing a new CPU core and when that ships to a consumer is closer to 3, 4, 5 years, right? So a lot of what we're seeing Intel's performance today was baked in years ago, right? When they started having those major issues transitioning first to 14 nanometer and then, of course, to 10. And now they try to kind of get things back on track. But that sort of threw that whole company off for half a decade minimum, right? So when you look at the broader PC space, ARM has not been a stranger to Windows, right? I mean, the very first Surface was a Windows RT-powered ARM device. It was running an old NVIDIA Tegra chip, but that was sort of something that came out like 2012 or something. And Microsoft has definitely dabbled not only with Windows RT, and now they have a full version of Windows 10, which I will say is much better than that first Surface ever was. We have hardware like the not only the Surface Pro, but we also have a number of different laptops that are taking advantage of Qualcomm's latest silicon. And we have app support, which is something that that first thing missed, right? Something that's interesting about the Apple Silicon transition is that in such a short amount of time, it seems like, at least on the Surface, that they've gotten a very wide variety of support by bringing in iPhone and iPad bad apps by, of course, having this really cultivated developer community. And also with just the simple fact they have incredibly powerful chips and with some smart stuff like Rosetta, they can almost kind of brute force their way into running older apps. If you look at what the competition does, if you look at specifically what you have on the Qualcomm side with the Snapdragon on Windows, it's fine, but the problem is that, first of all, while they do have a lot of the same kind of compatibility stuff, it's more hit or miss. Sort of, you don't have that full support for every single Windows app like you seem to generally have on the Mac side, and the performance just simply isn't there, right? So if you take some of these leaked Geekbench numbers, for example, the Apple Silicon stuff seems to be literally twice the performance of what you get on even the most recent Snapdragon stuff running on Windows, right? That is not a small difference. I mean, you can do all the software and the optimization you want, but ultimately, if you're talking about something which is double the performance, it's hard to make up that kind of delta, especially when you don't have the apps to support it.
So let's move on and talk a little bit about the products. Apple started with the MacBook Air. Every time Apple mentions the MacBook Air, you know, they say everyone loves it and it's the most popular Mac we sell. And I think that's definitely true. I think that's why the MacBook Air continues to exist, because their idea of, oh, the MacBook, we'll just replace it. And people want the MacBook Air, right? They want the name, they want the wedge shape. And it goes first, but it does pick up something from that 12-inch MacBook, that it's fanless. Shelley, when you look at that MacBook Air and you see what it can do, who do you think this machine is for now?
I think it's for somebody who wants a value-priced Apple device and who probably isn't ready to go full iPad. Somebody who likes a Mac laptop and who either, although the price for the next machine we'll talk about is not as much of a delta as it has been in the past, at least not for the moment. But they want something that is reasonably affordable and that's also portable, but that doesn't necessarily have the baggage that Mac fans might feel an iPad comes with, mainly in terms of like having to carry multiple objects, or I have to have a keyboard, various things like that. I want ports, that sort of thing. So I feel like the MacBook Air, and it is also, because it's so powerful, potentially for somebody who's trying to decide whether the lowest end Apple laptop is for them, and they may say, you know what, given what I do, given the kind of work I do, and the power of this chip, a MacBook Air potentially allows me to get a slightly less expensive Mac laptop than I otherwise would have had to, especially since, you know, the GPUs are integrated, and there's no fan, and it's, you know, there's not a lot of a downside, I think.
The thing that I really think about is that you may have had a case in the past where someone got a MacBook Air and then they outgrew it, right? Or it got to a point where it wasn't something that could meet their needs as their needs grew. And what I just keep thinking about with this is, gosh, the headroom on this seems incredible.
Yeah, I think it's like a really interesting thing to see. I mean, of course, we can look at the benchmarks and all this kind of stuff all we want, but until we spend real time with these things and find the limits, it's hard to know. But every indication right now is that these things are incredibly powerful. And it's just not a surprise, because like all of the chips, like Apple's been making incredible chips for years. The problem, and I don't even think this is necessarily a real problem, but like the issue with really seeing those performance or limits is that when you have it in a phone, I mean, what are you doing on your phone 99% of the time? You're scrolling Twitter, you're watching YouTube. I mean, you're not flexing the capabilities of that A14. When you put in something like a Mac, right, and you start loading up multiple streams of 4K ProRes, or you're transcoding some Blu-rays, or you're playing a game, like whatever the case is, there are so many more intensive tasks there that I think it's going to be a real eye-opener for a lot of people. Especially when you look at, again, how the Intel side of the house maybe hasn't evolved at the same kind of pace.
So the MacBook Air looks the same, costs the same, just way faster. It seems like a win.
And nice and cool.
Nice and cool, hopefully. Yeah,
yes,
but definitely
hopefully.
Silent. Definitely silent. The Mac Mini is, I think, a lot more interesting to talk about, because they really just replaced kind of a low-end spec Mac Mini. The Intel Mac Mini is still for sale. It's space gray. The Apple Silicon Mac Mini is silver, so it's not as pro, you know, because I've never felt talked down to by Apple, like when they said, you know, oh, it's space gray now. We know pros are going to love that. I'm like, do I? Like, what if I don't? Am I not a pro?
I love silver.
Yeah. Yeah, silver looks great. The Mac Pro is silver, so I guess it's not a pro machine.
Clearly. Return it.
roll it right back to the Apple Store.
Yeah, exactly.
What I keep thinking about with the Mac Mini in particular is there feels like there's room for something above this in the line. That this isn't, even though it's going to be way faster than the Intel Mac Mini, the storage and the RAM isn't as flexible, doesn't have as many ports. Austin, do you think there's room in like the Mac Mini family for a bigger sibling?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to me, this seems like, hey, we're going to make an updated version of the DTK for developers, right? I mean, that was, I felt like half of the conversation about the Mac Mini was like, look how fast it is in Xcode. Oh, how wonderful it is to have this cheap native box that you can run all of these apps on. Like, to me, this seems like a really clear case of how they're getting something out the door right now. I'm sure it's fairly straightforward to take advantage of the chassis, especially considering that they already ship to developers a version of the Mac Mini, essentially, which was how pretty much all of these Apple Silicon apps were developed. So yeah, to me, it's like as soon as we see the M1X or the M2 or whatever they decide to call it, I think it would be very easy to drop that in the Mac Mini, especially because if you look at the actual internals of the Mac Mini, there's a lot of empty space, right? I mean, they're not even filling it up, right? So I think it would be very easy when they have a version of the chip, which not only has more performance and you can, you know, fit a bigger heatsink or whatever, but also importantly, you do have, like you said, more RAM. Because I think 16 gigs is fine, but not really great, especially if you have sort of more demanding workloads. And for me, I know that the two Thunderbolt ports might be a slight issue. I know obviously we'll talk about the MacBook Pro side later, but even on something like a Mac Mini, I generally use three Thunderbolt peripherals at a time, right? And I certainly am using all of the ports on something like a MacBook, or if I have four, I'm going to use it. So I do think that is a little bit of a concern. And just a little side note, they dropped the 10 gig option. That was such a nice thing. Like, we have a couple of the, actually, we have three of the Mac Minis, which we've used. First of all, we had them connected with, like, for editing stations, and you're using the eGPUs, which obviously that has sort of, that support has been dropped in Apple Silicon. But having that 10 gig Ethernet on board was a huge win, because every single one of our systems in the office uses 10 gig to connect to our servers. And anything that doesn't have 10 gig, we have to then eat up another Thunderbolt port and spend $200 on another adapter, which obviously is less than ideal.
Yeah, I wonder if that is something that a M1X or whatever the bigger sibling is maybe brings that back in, because that's also available on the iMac Pro and the Mac Pro. In fact, I think on those two machines, it's the default. So yeah, I was a little disappointed by that. But in a machine that now costs $100 less at $699 to get into it, I can kind of understand it. But I just hope that they don't leave the quote proness of the Mac Mini behind.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it was really important to them to have that price point, because they want people to get into these. And they probably are aware that what Austin was saying about it being sort of another version of the development machine, that's absolutely right. And they're probably aware that the people that are going to be deciding to buy these are tinkerers or developers or people for whom this is not going to be their primary machine. And if somebody came to me and said, should I buy a Mac Mini? I would say, well, probably not as your primary machine, because something else is likely coming along. Even if you're not looking for an iMac, even if you're willing to stick to something that's in the Mac Mini class, there is probably something else that's going to be better that's going to come in 6 months or so.
You know, I'll say something. If I could just rewind back to when I was a teenager and just getting into video editing, if I could have bought a Mac Mini that could handle the multiple streams of ProRes and with Final Cut and everything like that, that would be killer. I do think there is a market for, in some ways, like the Mac Mini to be like that ultimate kind of like first Mac experience to try to get your feet wet with a lot of the new apps and features, but specifically having something which, well, sure, if we're sitting here talking about our 10 gig Ethernets and our four Thunderbolt ports, yeah, okay, we might miss that. But I think a lot of people would not be used to that huge workflow and just want a small, quiet, fairly affordable machine that can do actually some real work.
I think the 4 points ports is the biggest deal, because like you, I want those 4 ports. And I can see a Mac Mini as a secondary machine, like in my life as a podcast workflow machine, not necessarily, maybe an editor, maybe not, we'd have to see, but at the very least I can run my podcast on it and I don't necessarily need the 4 Thunderbolt ports. But that's what's going to keep it from becoming a desktop machine. Say if I want to attach another monitor so I don't need an iMac, it's going to prevent it from being a desktop machine because it just doesn't have enough ports for me.
And thankfully, Apple makes a reasonably priced display. Oh. Oh, no.
You mean the display that has a stand, which is more expensive than the entire Mac Mini? That one?
That's the one. Yeah. Yeah, it's a bummer. So let's move to the MacBook Pro. We mentioned it a second ago. And like the Mac Mini, this is the entry-level MacBook Pro. So since 2016, the 13-inch has been really two machines. There's been the two-port of it. At first, it didn't even have a touch bar. It gained a touch bar more recently, but two ports, and then there was the more powerful four port. And in the Intel world, those two internally were really different. The two port had a lower TDP. It was less powerful. The four port really was a more beefy machine. I can't help but think that's going to continue, but Shelley, like you, I was a little surprised to see the 13-inch MacBook Pro, and even more surprised that, at least on paper, the only difference between the two, between the MacBook Pro and the MacBook Air, is the active cooling, which Apple calls it, which is a fan. It's a fan. Like, it's just right. It's a spinning active piece of plastic. Cooling. Shelley, what do you think about that division? Like, do you think it's confusing that the Air and Pro seem like they're so similar?
In a word, yes. And I also think it's confusing that the low-end Pro and the higher-end Pro are so different. There's not really a story to tell. It's like, okay, we have this older technology. It's familiar. It's got more ports, but it's slower because we've just told you that the M1 is super awesome. So you really should buy the low-end Pro, except it only has two I don't get it. It doesn't make a great deal of sense to me.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that till you said it, that the quote low-end MacBook Pro will smoke the high-end MacBook Pro in terms of.
And there's a big price difference between the two. It's very tempting to get the low-end one for the processor speed, and you're just like, oh, well, I'll just suck it up about the ports. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's what I would do if I were in the market for one, but I'd grumble about it, and then I'd have to get some sort of dongle town situation going in order to get some more ports.
Austin, what do you think about this two-port machine still existing at all? Do you wish that they could had just waited and, you know, all MacBook Pros have four ports, the MacBook Air has two ports? Do you think that would have been simpler?
Yeah, but I think that there's a little bit of growing pains with any kind of big transition like this, right? I totally understand that the chip that they have designed has clear limits in how much memory it can access, clear limits in how many PCI lanes that they're using to connect to Thunderbolt. Like, I'm okay with this. I don't think it's a long-term solution. Like, if this was, you know, we're 3 years from now and they're still shipping one MacBook Pro with two ports, like, I'd be like, okay, that's not cool. But I'm willing to give them a little bit of the benefit of the doubt to come, like, right out the gate. I will say, like, there are some major improvements on the MacBook Pro compared to the Air. So the previous Air did actually have a fan, but it was an ineffective fan, but it wasn't attached to the heatsink, so it was maybe not the most powerful machine in the world. But I do think that when you get into heavier workloads, right, the active cooling experience that they've designed carefully in Johnny Ive's laboratory, I think that that actually will make a fairly large difference when it comes to, you know, those sustained loads and making sure that you keep those clock speeds up. But ultimately, I think most people will be better served for now going with the Air. Because on the Air, I don't care about two ports. That's fine. I don't care about having 100 nits less on my screen or a couple hours less battery life. Like, that's completely understandable for the price and for the trade-off. On the Pro, I'm very excited to get my hands on it. And I want to try dailying that machine and really feeling out how Apple Silicon will sort of fit into my life. But if I don't have a upgraded version of that in the next 6 to 12 months, that's when I'll be disappointed. For now, I'm totally willing to take it.
Yeah, there's definitely another shoe, at least one more, probably many more shoes to drop in this. I think it is important to remember that this is the entry level stuff, and that what I'm excited about is to see hopefully how good these are, just to kind of imagine what that could be scaled up to an iMac, a 16-inch MacBook Pro, even beyond. Real quickly, because I want to let you all go, but one big deal in this is that Apple Silicon Macs can run iOS and iPad OS apps just out of the box. Now, developers, you know, can opt out of that, and some have already said that they are, but it does mean that you can download one of those apps and just run them on your Mac. Apple did not demo this, so I don't know if anyone actually knows yet what this is like, but do you have any thoughts on what this means for the future of the Mac. Is the Mac just becoming an iPad without a touchscreen?
I mean, it doesn't have a touchscreen. It does, so you don't have a touch interface that you would an iOS app. So I'm curious to find out what the experience will be like as a Mac user using an iOS app. I know a lot of people have specific iOS apps that they love that are not on the Mac. I am not one of those people, but I can understand their excitement about that. I have other interests and concerns, some of which have to do with how are we going to do accessibility stuff, because even though some of the accessibility features in iOS and macOS have the same name, they're actually very different. They operate differently. How is it going to, so basically which one is going to take priority if you have a Mac app or an iOS app? Are we going to be in a metaphor that resembles more one platform versus the other? And if I'm in an iOS app and I'm not using a touchscreen, what alternative ways of interacting with that app am I going to have to learn in order to make that work for me? So I'm excited to try it. It seems like a lot of fun, but I don't know that it's actually going to be specifically beneficial to my productivity, because most of the thing, and maybe it's just because I'm a Mac user and I want to continue to be, but most of the things that I use that are in common to macOS and iOS, I don't use a lot of iOS apps that are just plain not available on the Mac, or if I do, they're things that I can sync to other things on the Mac, and that's just the world that I live in, but I realize that not everybody lives in that world.
Yeah, it's really interesting because going into this, like, this is, I will be honest, probably the most hyped Apple event for me personally of the year. I mean, I was very excited at WWDC, but like, I really wanted to see what these things were going to be capable of. And I'm certainly not disappointed in any way at the performance, right? It is absolutely just as good as I had hoped it would be. But the hardware is a little bit underwhelming, I suppose. I mean, obviously, we can talk about the ports and this kind of stuff, but they took it safe, right? And I was pretty confident after seeing the initial Apple Silicon announcement. As soon as they say, oh, yeah, we're going to be running iOS apps, I'm like, okay, hold on. How do you do that without a touchscreen? Like, to me, that was like a giant red flag of course it's going to be touch. Of course, right? This is finally the time they're going to introduce touch to the Mac. But they just, it works. It's fine. I don't necessarily think that the iOS apps are the end of the world. I think in a lot of ways, that's almost more of a nudge to developers. Like, hey, you know, it's already working on the Mac. Why don't you just, you know, take a few minutes and get it all polished up and get those keyboard shortcuts ready, right? Like, that kind of feels like the way that this is intended, especially with the decision to have it set where your app will pretty much go onto the Mac and be compatible unless you opt out versus the other way around. Like, that, to me, is like a, hey, we're Apple, please support a new platform. Thanks, guys. But without a touchscreen, I do see that there's some limitations there. And like a lot of the apps that I would use on my phone, I don't know if I would use with a touchpad or a mouse and keyboard. That seems like it might be a little bit of a strange experience.
Yeah, I think we just have to see. The way I think about it is kind of twofold. One, it feels like a pushback against things like Electron, where you just have web apps and wrappers. What if Slack could just have their iPad app on the Mac? Would that be a better experience, or would people prefer that? And some people would, I think. And so I think it's a little bit of a pushback against the Mac becoming just a fancy Chromebook, you know, where you're doing everything in the browser or in apps that are effectively browsers. But the other way I think about it is Apple's platforms are kind of like the Russian nesting dolls, the word that I can't pronounce. How do you pronounce it? I can't do it.
Oh, don't ask me.
No one knows. It's impossible to know. Where, okay, so some iPhone apps also run on the Apple Watch, and the iPad can run its apps and iPhone apps. And now the Mac can run iPhone apps, iPad apps, and what we would consider sort of traditional Mac apps. We can't say native because these run natively, but traditional Logic, Final Cut, Desktop Safari, Finder, right? These apps that have been on the Mac for a long time. And so the way I kind of choose to view it, as a Mac fan at least, is it makes the Mac the most flexible platform Apple has, and maybe the most flexible app platform out there. I mean, there's been lots of experimentation with running Android apps on Chrome OS, and that's been, I think, a mixed bag. But it means that you can buy a Mac and you can run basically anything on it that runs on any other Apple platform. And that's pretty cool. And it's a powerful move.
I mean, it still feels like it's about developers because you've given them this way to opt out, which is kind of an interesting method of getting them to not be mad at you for forcing them to go a particular way. But at the same time saying, OK, don't be mad. Don't be mad. But we have this really great idea. And hopefully they'll come, you know, hopefully from Apple's point of view, they'll come along and say, this is the way we want to go, because they're going to need a lot of buy-in if they're going to completely merge the operating systems, or if macOS goes away in some form or fashion. You can't just fiat that into existence, even if you are Apple, and you're going to need not only users. I mean, we talk about whether we want to run individual apps on our Macs, which is, you know, for our own entertainment and testing and the like. But really, the developer community has to be seen to be behind this change in from Apple's point of view, or it's not going to work. It's just going to be a mess.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Well, it's an exciting time to be a computer nerd, like we said. Austin and Shelley, thank you so much for joining me. Austin, where can people find you?
Yeah, so of course on the fine Relay FM podcast network at /thetestdrivers or test drivers, both of them work. But yeah, so that's the show that I co-host with Mike. And besides that, YouTube.com/AustinEvans is my main home.
What about you, Shelley?
Well, my show here on Relay is called Parallel. It's a tech podcast with accessibility sprinkles, and you can just find that at relay.fm/parallel. You can also follow me on Twitter at @shelly, or if you're interested in accessibility and iOS, iOS Access Book on Twitter is where you can find out about the book that I'm going to publish any minute now about iOS 14 and accessibility.
Well, thank you all for joining me. Members, thank you for your support of Relay FM. It really means a lot to us. And until next month.